now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Delphi podcast. I'm Tom Shaughnessy, and I help lead Delphi Ventures, as well as host some of the most in-the-weeds and thought-provoking guests across crypto, spanning layer ones to DeFi, NFTs, and beyond. The goal is to have fun, but also to dive deep and offer foundational episodes on projects and founders. Also, check out our research on Delphi Digital or miss out on the most compelling research there is. It's up to you. As a reminder, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. Delphi Ventures may hold tokens mentioned, so check out our transparency page in the show notes for more info. With that, let's dive in. See you guys on the other side. Before we jump in, we'd like to thank our sponsors for making this episode possible. Kava is a cross-chain DeFi platform that gives you the ability to earn more by connecting the world's largest cryptocurrencies, ecosystems, and financial applications in one safe and seamless integration. We're excited for the upcoming launch of the Swap Protocol, a cross-chain AMM liquidity hub bridging DeFi, blockchains, and financial services to swap the world's largest assets and maximize yields across your entire portfolio. Swap will join the Kava Protocol and Hart Protocol as the next application built on the Kava platform. Celo is a mobile-first platform that makes financial dApps and crypto payments accessible to anyone with a mobile phone, providing the opportunity to positively impact the users of 6 billion smartphones in circulation today. Celo's eco-friendly proof-of-stake consensus mechanism and ultra-mobile light client makes up to 17,000 times faster than other blockchains and accessible to mobile phone users around the world. Visit Celo.org to learn more. Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Tom Shaughnessy. I help run Delphi Ventures. Today, I'm thrilled to have on another guest for our NFT culture series, Von Mises. Von Mises, how's it going?
It's good. Glad to be here. Thank you for having me on. Excited to talk about what's happening in NFTs and wherever else the conversation goes.
Man, I could probably spend an hour talking about how jealous I am of your collection. I mean, you're one of the most prolific collectors in the space. I mean, your collection is just, it's just so incredible.
Thank you. I've definitely worked hard to get it where it is. And, I didn't really have the expectations of, you know, value being generated this quickly, but it's cool to see other people recognizing, you know, how interesting and compelling and historic a lot of this stuff is. And I'm very excited to see where it leads us all.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there. It's definitely happening faster than I expected as well. Well, tell me a bit about your journey. How'd you get started in crypto and I guess NFTs and art?
You know, I got involved in Bitcoin in 2011. I made a $5,000 investment, and basically everything has spawned from that. In addition to buying some Bitcoin for cash, I also leased a mining rig back in 2011. And when the thing first was set up, it was generating like 3 Bitcoin a day, which is like, you know, pretty crazy to think about now. But in very short time, it was generating less than a quarter of a Bitcoin a day. And that was, you know, evident by the amount of new computational power coming onto the Bitcoin network at the time. You know, and I just really kind of just focused on Bitcoin for a while and really didn't get involved in too much other stuff. And I was, had a real job, so it wasn't like a full-time, you know, thing I was focused on at the time. And then got into Gods Unchained because I had played some Magic the Gathering in the past. And, you know, although that wasn't a great Bitcoin, although that wasn't a great investment, at least not yet, I am actually still hopeful for that one. It did lead me down the NFT rabbit hole and brought me to CryptoPunks, where, you know, pretty much right away, I was like, this is definitely something special, and made numerous posts about how I was looking at things in the CryptoPunk Discord, which, you know, those comments have all aged pretty incredibly well. And I definitely have screenshotted some of them and shared them. And, you know, I felt like right away, I knew this was something interesting as someone who collected a lot of different things in my life, you know, combining the historical aspect of CryptoPunks just with the whole collecting narrative. It was, you know, for me, it was something that I knew I had to get involved with. And I probably owned maybe 100 plus punks over my NFT career. At the peak, I had probably 65, and I've sold down to, I think I still have 27. But I always used a collector mentality where I sold, you know, my floors and least desirable punks in order to be able to maintain and hold on to my most desirable ones. And so the 27 I have left are, you know, pretty good punks. So happy to have that. And then, you know, once I really got into CryptoPunks, then it really opened up the whole, you know, ball game to what I was interested in. And even though I wasn't necessarily interested in a lot of the other NFTs initially, recognizing that this was kind of a land grab and a golden opportunity to really be involved in the space, I started going after Autoglyphs and bought Axies and bought really OG top tier CryptoKitties and Decentraland land and a lot of NFTs. I know you guys are pretty active in the Axie space. When I bought my first Mystic Axie, I paid 5 ETH for it, and it was one that had that starry balloon. That was my first Axie. It was Starry Balloon Mystic Axie Virgin. And I was like, oh, I'm paying 5 ETH. I'm totally top ticking this. I was like, you know, this is dumb. And maybe, and ETH was probably at like 600 at the time. So I was like, you know, I paid 3,000 for this Axie. You know, I'm definitely going to lose money on this one, but I just need to have a stake in it. And then, you know, I ended up buying
it. It was a good buy.
Yeah, it was a good buy. Yeah. Solid return. So, yeah, and I've bought a bunch of other Axies. I have a really good double Mystic Axie. I have a bunch of Axie shards that we can get into later. A bunch of Frosties. Raster Eye turned me onto the Frosties, and I have a bunch of, like, I think I have 6 or 7 of them, and a couple of them. Like, I have one that's got 5 Christmas parts, which is, there's only a couple of those, so that one's pretty cool. And I have a 4 Christmas part Virgin also, which is pretty valuable one too. So yeah, nice. I think Axies are pretty cool.
Yeah, and no, I like between them. You and Raster's collection, you guys have incredible collections. So if I understand correctly, you got started pretty early on. You played Magic the Gathering in the past. I also played, you know, TBT, my reanimate deck and burn deck. But when you found punks, nice. It sounds like you pretty much went all in. Like, what was the strategy there? It was just let me buy kind of 50 or 100 of these at the floor, or what was your thesis there?
No, it was kind of like, you know, I think everyone buys a floor punk first. It's just like how you dip your toe in. But like my second or third purchase was a pilot helmet. That's one of my most prized punks to this day. And I remember it was 5 ETH, and an ETH was at $200 at the time. So it was $1,000 for this. And I remember like agonizing over it. And I'm like, oh, I'm top ticking this. This is so, what am I doing? I'm like, this is really, you know, I'm like, all right, I have to have it. There's only 54 of these. Like, if I'm gonna play in this space, I have to pick up some rare ones. But I also realized right away that it was extremely difficult to get really clean, good-looking punks. And when those things would pop up, they would trade extremely quickly. And I mean, I basically, you know, didn't leave my computer. Like, I always had my hardware wallet ready to rock. And if something popped up, I was sniping it. And I realized quickly that I had to do it. So I also,
just a quick question there. So you don't like, it's like a longer question, but you're more interested in the aesthetics versus like the attributes or properties of a punk. Would that be fair, or would that be?
I think that because people, you know, because this is art as well, I think that you definitely have to have a very keen eye for the aesthetics of it. And I feel really strongly that, you know, now, especially where this market has, you know, obviously gone up, you know, huge amounts, and people are using them as their profile, you know, having the eye for the aesthetics was a very key distinction, because people are really paying up now for punks with strong eye appeal. So, you know, like as an example, I have this, you know, a cowboy punk, I think it's 8981 is the number. I mean, I remember when I saw this, my friend Carlini had owned it. He listed it. I mean, I was on it from the second he listed it. And like, you know, this guy's like basically the Marlboro man of crypto punks. And, you know, I wouldn't sell, I would say at least once a month, someone contacts me and asks me about this punk. And, you know, I'm always like, trust me, you're not going to pay what I want for it. And someday somebody will pay me what I want for it. But no, I mean, I think that, and this is the thing I like about generative art as well as CryptoPunks, is that it's always a balance between aesthetics and rarity. And of course, absolutely, rarity, especially in CryptoPunks, is probably the primary determinant in value of value. But ultimately, when you combine it with aesthetics, that's where you can really start getting some crazy numbers. And I think this has very strongly been shown lately, where, you know, when I was first into punks, you might pay a 20% premium for a punk that had, you know, really, really strong eye appeal. And now you know, you can go look at cowboy punks, and a cowboy punk with great aesthetics could trade it 2-3 times the floor value now. So massive, massive difference. A friend of mine wanted to buy a punk a while back, and we ended up, I helped them get it. And it was a cowboy punk, a very nice looking cowboy punk. And, you know, we paid basically the floor price for this cowboy punk. And my whole thesis to my friend was, this has the potential to trade at a substantial premium. And when they sold the punk a few months later, we bought the punk for like $3,000, and it sold 4 months later for $180,000. And when it sold at like, you know, it sold at 2x the floor price for cowboy hats, and cowboy hats were trading at a double the premium of the overall punk floor price. So, yeah, I mean, I think aesthetics, as the market matures, as the money goes up, obviously people are going to pay up. I mean, owning something rare that is unattractive doesn't really offer much value, in my opinion. There are people that will collect simply for the statistical rarity, but you cannot just focus on statistical rarity at any aspect that's considered, that has any type of artistic appeal. You cannot just focus on rarity.
So that's a really strong and a good take, and one I agree with. But I guess the majority of people probably act differently because they don't have your level of experience. Like when there's a new art box drop, or when there's a new, you know, gen art drop, or just a normal PFP drop on OpenSea, I feel like everybody's clamoring to figure out what's rare, what's not, let's ape it. So it sounds like there's a pretty big arb here on just buying what looks fantastic early on versus kind of getting too caught up in the attributes.
Well, I mean, I had a very high-end collector recently contact me and wanted my opinion on Fidenza. And this is somebody who, and I like the fact that people want my opinions on these things. I think it's cool that I, you know, people want to somewhat of a consensus, because there's a lot going on. And I think that it is important that, especially in the art blocks world, especially because it has even more of an artistic take on it than a CryptoPunk, that you have to at least start with something objective. And so I think rarity is a very good place to start. And I think something that's really rare will typically always trade better than something that's common but really good looking. So I think that you do have to bring in rarity where rarity is relevant. But ultimately, once you get into that rarity, a certain rarity bucket, then you can have massive differences in prices based on aesthetic. Like, no one's going to ever value a punk that has floor-like characteristics above where a beanie is, because there's only 44 beanies and it's super desirable. And so even an ugly beanie is going to always trade better than a floor punk. So, you know, it's part skill, part objectivity, but also part feel. And I think that's kind of where, you know, someone like me or someone like you who've been doing it for a while can balance all these different things to put it to where you have a fair value and people can agree. Like, I mean, I've priced punks where people were like, that's ridiculous, it's never going to trade there. And then a month later, someone buys it and it trades at 2.5 times the floor price. And everyone's like, you know, how did you know that? How did you do that? It's like, well, look at it. I mean, this is way better than the average for this rarity. So I think really, like, you start with rarity, and then within a rarity group, you can have massive differences based on the aesthetics. And I think that's the thing that people need to focus on. So yeah, I'm not saying that a floor punk is going to trade better than a beanie, but a floor punk could potentially trade better than something that has a reasonable degree of rarity, but doesn't look that good.
No, that's totally fair. I like your like multi-pronged approach here, right? Like you're going to focus on attributes and parameters. And then after that, you can use kind of your subjective skill and experience to figure out, you know, what's important and what looks great and what could trade higher. That's a really good point. And I guess the other question for you here is like your collection is massive, right? Like you have thousands of NFTs, I'm sure across multiple wallets, but I'm just looking at the public one. Like, you know, earlier in the episode or when we first started recording, you said like your strategy is kind of to get rid of this floor, to go for quality. But I guess, how do you manage that, right? Because like, if you see a new drop, you kind of want to ape in, get a lot of the NFTs in that collection, and then I guess eventually sell the floor versions and hold on to the quality. But it seems like a bit of a moving target, right? Like, how do you handle just straight up inventory management on your collection?
Hard. I mean, it definitely is. I mean, it's a full-time job. I mean, like, you know, when things were really pumping hard from like mid-July through the end of August, you know, I mean, I feel like the entire month of August, like I remember looking at the calendar and it was like September 5th. And I'm like, wow, like did the whole month of August just go by? Like it's a full-time job trying to stay on top of everything. And yeah, I mean, like I'm constantly looking at floor prices, looking at different rarity tiers, looking at the collection overall, trying to decide what can be sold. You know, definitely starting from the lower level stuff and working up from there. So, you know, I do think there's a lot of liquidity in the floor, so there is value to be had selling the floor. It's one of the easier things to do. A lot of people will take the approach of selling their best pieces because that's where they're going to generate the biggest bang for the buck. But in reality, you know, selling your top tier pieces in general, in my opinion, is a mistake because the high end can always completely detach from reality, you know? And I mean, I kind of wrote about this in a Twitter, I guess I'd call it a rant, which I don't usually do. It was kind of like a stream of consciousness where I was talking about, I have a zombie punk and I had it listed and it was basically on the floor at maybe like, I don't know, 1300 ETH or something like that at the time. And I started up talking about how, you know, if you own a CryptoPunk, you realistically own one of the top 1% of NFTs in existence. And if you further divide that and look at ape, alien, and zombies, they're about 1%. That's slightly more. I think there's 130 of, you know, between the three of them. So if you own a zombie, you basically own one of the top 1% of the top 1% NFTs. And, you know, from my perspective, looking forward, I think there's going to be a lot more upside in crypto overall and a lot more wealth created in this space. And, you know, people want a digital flex. And, you know, what does the 1% of the 1% digital flex mean in a club of, you know, billionaires effectively? I mean, it can completely detach from reality. So even though, you know, let's say a zombie would sell for $5 million right now, and that sounds insane that I could potentially sell a zombie for $5 million. But I think that there's the potential that you're in a world that there's going to be so much wealth created in the space. And I'm very bullish on crypto and DeFi and NFTs that, I don't know. I mean, like, what's the ultimate flex worth? I mean, if you own a zombie CryptoPunk, there's literally only 33 that are better. There's, I think, 24 apes and nine aliens. Like, you know, to have the 35th best flex in a club of billionaires, it's not going to be cheap.
No, I'm so, with you. Buying a flex is important. And I guess my next question for you, and I don't want to share too much about our conversations offline, but, you know, squiggles are something that I just fell in love with, right? Like the first art blocks gen release. And I kind of got addicted to just looking at, you know, mm-hmm. whether one was ribbed or perfect spectrum or pipe or slinky, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time just looking at, you know, floor squiggles versus the high-end versions. And, you know, we're an investor in fractional, so we spend a lot of time there. And one of the questions I have for you is, you know, you're totally right. There's only a couple of, like, let's say a high-end punk, a high-end squiggle, take your pick. But I guess my question for you is, in a world where, you know, let's say the rarest versions of these NFTs get fractionalized and you have, you know, millions of shards and millions of owners, do you think people will still care enough to buy a floor punk? Like, if I can buy part of a perfect spectrum ribbed squiggle, or if I can buy part of a zombie ape, alien, like, do you think that people will still want to buy the floor, or do you think that they'll just want to kind of, you know, quote, ape into part of the rarest versions?
I'm kind of torn on fractional ownership, to be honest with you. I don't really love it. And, like, you know, as someone who has a large collection and a large high-end collection, like, I should be a bigger fan of it because it's potentially a source of great liquidity for me. But I don't know. I don't really love it. And I don't think that people are going to necessarily look. I do think there's a future for this stuff. So don't, I'm not super bearish on it. I just feel like the mechanism to get these assets out, no matter, you know, looking at both of the versions that are pretty popular right now, whether it's fractional.art or whether it's NIFTEX or whatever it's called, like, the mechanisms are both very challenging. And I think that's going to really limit values at the high end. Now, look, ultimately, maybe there's another solution that's going to come along and make it more streamlined and people are going to gravitate toward it. Or it may just be a function that these, both of these markets grow to the point where there's reliable market making and good liquidity and people, you know, buying and selling fractions. And that would be great. Almost like a stock exchange. You know, like, I mean, ultimately maybe that's the vision that changes my view on it, but I don't know. I think people are always going to want to own the asset. I do. I think there's going to always be a strong bid for floor swiggles, floor crypto punks. I don't think that's ever going to change. I think that it's possible that as some of these really high-end pieces detach from reality and get into, you know, even more stratospheric type levels, that maybe there will be, the only way to own them will be through fractionalization or corporate ownership or who knows the structure. But I mean, I don't see the market for, you know, especially something like squiggles or CryptoPunks, where there's 10,000 of them, you're ever going to see people not want to own their own punk. I don't see that happening. But I don't know. I can't see the future, you know, so I'm not really sure.
No, that's fair. I mean, I think new people to the space want the financial upside of potentially owning part of, like, the New York Yankees here. You know what I mean? But I totally get your point here. Like, if you want that sense of ownership, like, you know, when I go on SquiggleDAO, like, you know, you need to squiggle to get in there, right? Like, I feel like a sense of community and ownership since I own a full one. And I guess the other problem with fractionalization, to your point, or not a problem, but just like a risk factor, is that, you know, if somebody buys you out, like, you kind of lose the sense of likeness and community that you've been using. So there definitely is a case for both sides here, for sure.
Yeah. I do not feel that as of right now, fractionalization is maximizing value, especially at the high end. So if you don't mind me asking, I know I talked about this a little bit, but, like, you know, I own fractions in Almex, ALMX, which is the Agmo Genesis Axie that was sharded a while back. I think it was sharded for 60 ETH. You know, I own it at a very, very cheap level. I think I own it at, like, I think almost 20% of it at probably like 100 ETH valuation. And this was when ETH was, like, you know, $500. So, like, I own close to 20% at like $10,000. Like, it's a stupid number. But you know, what is something like that worth? I mean, I absolutely don't think that the pool and the market is reflecting the value of that. I mean, to me, that's probably ape type punk level, if not possibly higher, in terms of rarity, and especially given the significance in the space. So, you know, like, I'm using this as an example where, like, I don't know, the market, which is very thin, there's nobody providing liquidity, and probably nobody's providing liquidity because it's too cheap. The market is not reflective of what this thing should be worth. And as a result, nobody wants to provide liquidity because nobody wants to sell their shards too cheaply. And it's, it's turning into a whale game where someone's going to have to put themselves out there and make a high offer. And the risk in that structure is that you then get bought out and then it sells for the real value, which could be 2,000, 3,000, who knows what the number is. So I'm just kind of curious what you think about that one specifically, as I would definitely consider you more of an expert on Axie than myself.
No, I appreciate that. I mean, to be honest, I do think it is an issue, right? Like you need, so I think for it to work, for fractionalization to work, it has to be for rare assets. It doesn't really work with floor assets because not a lot of buyers, mm-hmm. not a lot of liquidity. But I think for rare assets that have a good following, if a good percentage of the supply is sold to the market, so not something like 5%, but you know something high, like 30 to 50% is sold, and then a good chunk of that is then put in the liquidity pool, then I think it could make sense and it could be efficient. And also if the shard count is high enough. So there are a couple of factors, but to your point, it does have to be a well-known NFT that's fractionalized with some type of, you know, rare attributes or community around it where people will feel the desire to kind of want to use that. I mean, the other question though becomes, you know, why would the other question becomes like, if you fractionalize rare Axie, can you still use it to game and to play with? And that's still kind of an outstanding question that I don't think is solved yet at all.
Right, right. Well, I mean, and obviously the asset has to get locked into a smart contract, so it definitely makes the playability or usability of it not possible, at least in the current form. But you know, speaking to what you just said, like I would say that Almace, I'm not really even sure if I'm saying it right, is a very well known and very rare Axie, and the shards are fully distributed. I don't think anyone owns more than 15% of that, of 18%. I'm probably one of the top holders in it. And I mean, I'm sitting at, I don't know, 16 or 17, 18, something around there. And there's almost no liquidity. There's no one that you can't even buy one ETH worth of this thing. It's been this way for months. So as we've seen this big move up in the Axie market overall, you really can't get a feel for where this should be because there's almost no action. And I get it. Like there's probably five or six people like me that are sitting with, you know, 5 to 15% of it. And we're all just kind of waiting for someone to come in and show the right level. But like, you know, genuinely, like I'm afraid to show an offer to buy it out because I know there's people like you just waiting for me to, and I'm not saying you specifically, but waiting for me to put 15% up and try to buy it out too low, and I'm going to get lifted out of my 15% instantly because you can't get 15%. So,
yeah, no, I totally hear where you're coming from. I mean, to be honest, we're investors in fractions. I'm a little more familiar there, but I mean, I've definitely seen more liquid secondaries there, just given the dynamics of what they're offering. Like, for example, like they have Fidenzas on there, like where they're, you know, I think it's Fidenza 900, where there's like 75% of the collectible supplies out there. So it makes it a bit more liquid, but you're right. And I mean, I think the Axie example of Niftex might be the result of a very early, more legacy asset. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. now when stuff gets fractionalized, it's like well-known, there's, you know, some good public support and this isn't an incentive, or I'm not telling people to go buy anything, but I think it's a little bit of a new world now versus when stuff was fractionalized earlier on. I know that's not a great answer, yeah. But I think that plays into it.
No, I hear you. The one thing that the thing about fractional.art, you know, and this is, I think, another potential issue. Now, I spoke to the devs when they were doing this, and I debated them about the buyout mechanisms, because I think the buyout mechanisms on these things is really kind of the key issue. You know, one of the things about when someone comes into the market and sets a new record high and lifts some, you know, like a ringer for whatever was $5 million that sold, the golden goose that sold a couple of weeks ago, the buyer of that gets an immediate pop because they're setting a new high in the market, and that causes this FOMO that will lift the value of a lot of other assets. The problem with fractional.art, in my opinion, is that the buyer loses that bump, because as soon as they initiate a buyout, they don't actually get the asset. It goes to an auction, and now they run the risk of them causing the FOMO that causes them to lose out on the high-end asset that they just wanted. So that disincents them from making the bid in the first place. So look, I realize that this is all still pretty early and there's a lot of different directions it may or may go in or change direction, but I don't think any of the current setups are really all that ideal to maximize value in the space. Now they all try to solve different problems.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, to be honest, I totally agree with you, right? Like the buyout mechanism to me is the most important. Like we checked out a lot of different providers here, right? And I mean, obviously the issue is you don't want stuff to get stuck. You want the ability to put the puzzle pieces back together. The thing that I did like on Fractional was that everybody sets their own pro rata reserve price. So if you own, say, 15% of that Axie, you know, you can say, I want, let's say, 10 million for it times 15%. And that's your kind of weight to drive the implied valuation, which then starts an auction. Anybody could start bidding. And then, you know, people can, whoever wins, people can redeem their shards for that escrowed ETH. To your point, though, I mean, it does hinge, you know, if there's a Fidenza that's fractionalized, and let's say another Fidenza sells for, you know, 10x or something like that, it does hinge on the collective community resetting what they think is a fair reserve price. So, I mean, on one side, you do have that inefficiency potentially, but on the other side, you do have kind of the community of owners saying, hey, you know what? I don't want to sell this unless it's X price, and they all reset. But to your point, it is an experiment of a bit on resetting those prices and seeing how efficient it is.
Yeah, I mean, when, again, you know, we are really early in the process still here, and so you know, I think that potentially as more institutions get involved, such as your group and others, I think the fractional markets may become more efficient and maybe more market making. You know, I was involved in Fidenza 527. And it got bought out on Fractional Art, and I think it went for too low, and I think that it's fine. It is what it is. But you know, the buyout mechanism I don't think is ideal. I really don't. But again, I don't know what's perfect. I think that the NIFTEX model has its challenges as well, but at least you can put a level out there and you can force someone to buy you out, or if they don't, you actually own the asset. But I think the biggest problem on any of these fractional sites is that the people that are typically buying these assets out are only looking to buy them out because they realize that the asset has more value outside of fractionalization. And I think that's the biggest issue. And I think that's...
No, that's a fair point. Yeah, I mean, that's one that only somebody of your experience would know, to be honest, right? I mean, like people, you know, retail aping into shards, they're never going to know the true value, right? Or, I mean, I'm just saying, I think people are a little lax when they're spending $100 or $1,000. Like, I don't think they're really going to look at the implied valuation and say, hey, you know what, this is actually worth 5 or 10x that.
Right, but in the same sense, the person that's investing $100 or $1,000 is not really going to have any true say over what that ultimate value of that is. Like, okay, so someone like myself or someone like you that are going to be making bigger level plays, you know, putting up 1 million or 2 million or whatever the number is to try to, you know, capture some value. Like, I mean, like I wouldn't mind buying Almaz out because I think that if it's free from the shackles of fractionalization, it can seek its own value. And if I can offer that to someone where they can actually buy it without having to go through the whole rigmarole of putting up the ETH and risking counterclaimed and 2-week lockup, like the value of that thing is probably 50% higher as soon as it comes out of fractionalization. And I think that's a big problem.
Yeah, no, it's fair concerns. Definitely stuff they got to contend with. But just to switch gears a little bit, I just have a different combo just to bring up with you because I want to, while we have time, the art block space is obviously obviously the premier platform for generative art. I mean, everything from squiggles to Fidenzas. I just had Eric on the pod. He is incredible. You're not only a mod, but you're a curator itself. I would love to pick your brain on this. I mean, curation is one of, in my opinion, the most important parts of NFTs and collecting. And, you know, obviously Artblox has its own curation board, whereas, you know, other projects are trying to use their token to incentivize kind of a community to curate. Then obviously we just have the open market where people say what's valuable, what's not. But would love to kind of get your take on art blocks, how the curation happens, and kind of get a look under the hood.
So I followed Eric to Art Blocks. I met him in the Punk Discord, and you know, I knew that he was on a level that nobody else, that at least I was able to interact with, was on. So, you know, purely and complete blind faith and trust in him. And I, like, as someone who's pretty knowledgeable in the space, I don't, you know, if some, when I meet someone who I know is, makes me feel stupid, that I want to follow this person. And, you know, not that he, Eric tried to make me feel stupid, but I knew that he knew stuff on a level that I didn't know. So I was fine following him and going there and getting very involved with it from the beginning, you know. And there wasn't a curation board in the beginning. So for the first, let's say 15 drops that Art Blocks had, everything was just, there was no curated factory and playground. That all evolved over the course of the first few months. And I was one of the first mods, and I was one of the first people to be asked to be on the curation board because of my heavy involvement with it right from the get-go. I think it's really amazing. I mean, the group of people that are on the curation board, I mean, it's really a who's who of people in the NFT space, from developers to artists to collectors, even people that are really outside of the NFT scene that have a strong art background or have technical backgrounds in programming. Like, there's really, it's quite an interesting group, and it's quite an interesting affiliation. I'm really pleased to be there. Sometimes I get busy and don't have time to go through the drops that are being scheduled every week. But, you know, typically what'll happen is Jeff will put out a note saying, okay, here's the prospective drops we're considering, you know, get your votes in by the end of the week. And there'll be a testnet with, you know, 50 to 100 mints from the drop. And, you know, we'll go through them. And then there's a closed discussion board where people on curation can discuss the finer points of it with other curation members. And then ultimately there's a vote, and then it's decided whether it's going to be eligible for curation or has to go to factory. And if it doesn't make curation, the artist can take the feedback that the curation board provides and potentially tweak it and resubmit. So that happens sometimes, and sometimes they resubmit and it's still doesn't make the grade, or sometimes they resubmit and they follow the, you know, guides or take the cues from some things that were said, and sometimes it makes it. So that's kind of how it works. And I think
I love that. And just to dive in there, not to cut you off, but like the curation process within Art Blocks, like how, I guess thinking out like 10 years, just to play devil's advocate here, like, do you feel like it's centralized? Do you feel like, because like there's a give and take here, like you guys are like, it's hard for me to describe how good you are and how good, you know, the board is, right? Like, it's hard to like quantify that. But on the flip side, you do want the community kind of deciding what's good, what's not good. And they obviously do that through their ability to pay. But what's your take on the centralization of like curation, I guess?
Eric is, you know, blockchain, decentralized, like, I mean, that he's super into that. So I have no idea what the future holds. I've never had this specific discussion with him regarding decentralizing curation, but he's a very knowledgeable blockchain person. I think that like he wants to launch this ultimately out into the world the way that it should be. So I don't know. I mean, is there the potential for curation decisions to be decentralized? It's definitely possible. I don't know if that's the plan. I like being on the curation board, and I like being able to influence the direction. And I think that, you know, the community as a whole, if they knew everybody that was on this board, you know, would feel that these people are probably pretty well suited to make these decisions. But in the same sense, as someone who's a big fan of decentralization and everything that the decentralized economy brings, you know, I can't say to you that the curation board is going to be the way it's always going to be done for Art Blocks. So I have no knowledge. I have no
that's happening. That's totally fair. Right. And to be honest, I love what you guys do. And frankly, I think you guys have incredible and unmatched experience. I'm just playing devil's advocate to kind of get the next sense.
Totally right.
Yeah. No. Is there anything that you like? Is there anything that came about that you were like, you know, absolutely not, I hate this. You know, I know you guys all love it. Like any strong views from you internally on anything that's kind of passed through our blocks, or was it generally kosher? Or I'm just kind of, you know, we obviously have our investment committee, so it's a bit of a give and take sometimes. So I'm kind of wondering how that maps right to kind of the curation board.
You know, there's been times that I thought something should be curated that wasn't, and there's been times that I thought things shouldn't be curated that were. But I think that in general, the ones that are that I've disagreed on, it's been close. And so, you know, if the other people on the board, you know, more of them voted in favor of it, I mean, I'm okay with it, and that's fine. And so I'm certainly not going to get into specific drops because that wouldn't be right. But I think there's always going to be somewhat difference of opinion. You know, I will say the one that surprised me recently, like geometry runners, I really, really liked. And I was surprised that the market doesn't really seem to love it. Maybe it's a function of it came at a time where there was a lot of extra FOMO going on in the art block space, and the drop came at a pretty high level. But, you know, like I think that's from a recent drop. I think that's really cool. I think Trosted also is really cool, and that doesn't seem to be getting a lot of traction. I remember seeing them on the curation board, you know, reviewing them and being like, wow, this is one of the more interesting ones I've seen. And I was definitely excited for both those drops. And it doesn't seem that the market, at least currently, feels the same way. It doesn't faze me in the least. I do know that those drops will get the attention that they deserve at some point. But no, I mean, those were ones that, you know, in general, the conversation from everybody was pretty positive on both those. And so, you know, I'm a tad surprised that they haven't done a little bit better, especially Trosset.
No, that's fair. I like the context. I'm laughing because I wish I just, you know, had time to just kind of ape every Artbox play. But to be honest, they're getting to a point where they're getting so expensive, you really can't, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, the stakes have gone up quite a bit. You know, in the early days when you could, you know, you could get 3 to 5%. I mean, I think I minted 3 to 5% of all of the first 15 drops, I would say, and not in any rush, no gas war, you know, all at like, you know, 0.05 to 0.15 type prices. And, you know, like, I mean, I minted 350 swiggles for about 10 ETH, and ETH was like $600. Like, I mean, you know, it's insane. It's insane. Yeah. It's crazy. No, it's crazy.
What's the craziest trade you've done? I mean, cutting off the rear of Artbox here, but like it may be for an Artbox asset, but like what's a trade or investment you've done? Not really price, but just maybe something just crazy. Like you had to go through a bunch of people, or what's like the wildest NFT story you have purchase wise?
I mean, I will tell you this, like, you know, I don't normally chase anything, but I got very busy. Like I do have an actual job that, you know, I'm kind of self-employed, but I do actually have a job I do also. And things got a little bit busy, and I missed the Fidenza drop. And I kind of was like in a lull for a couple of weeks. And I, you know, started seeing them and I was like, oh, they're interesting. But, and I started seeing prices go up. And I will tell you, when I finally realized I needed to get them, I went pretty crazy. For about 2 weeks straight, all I did was chase Fidenzas. And it was not easy to do because although prices at the time still weren't that high, people were still holding on to them. And I was really surprised at the offers I was making people and getting turned down. And so I really had to step up. So I would say that, you know, chasing the spiral Fidenza that I got, you know, was a process. At the time, I paid 50 ETH for my spiral Fidenza. At the time, it was the highest price I'd ever paid for an NFT. So, you know, like when I finally woke up to it and started chasing it, I chased pretty hard on those. So I would say that this was one, if I maybe had a little bit more time to think about it, I could probably come up with a better story. I did chase Tweety pretty hard early on to get a bunch of really rare art blocks pieces too. And I mean, like constantly sending emails, constantly sending Discord messages.
Are you ever
saying,
like,
hey, what do you think?
Like when you hit these guys up though, I mean, like, you know, let's say you start going crazy for Fidenzas, and trust me, I know your connections and friends in the space are, you know, have your back, but are you ever concerned, like, you know, hey, Von Mises is looking for Fidenzas, you know, everyone double their price. Like, I'm always wondering, like, well, if there's,
I mean, thankfully, that problem has only happened much more recently. It used to not be. It used to be, oh, Von wants to overpay for this art block piece. Let me see if I can dump it on him. That's how it used to be. So.
Oh, man. Yeah.
One of my friends recently asked me, he's like, hey, I need your opinion on this apparition. And apparition is not one of the more, you know, popular drops. But I took a look at it and I'm like, and it was a really good one. And I said to him, oh, I think this is a pretty good one. Here's what I think. I go, you interested in selling it? He goes, not anymore.
Oh, man.
And it went right into his vault account. He's like, you're never going to see this one. So, you know, I mean, look, but like, I do appreciate that people want my opinions on some of this stuff. And I always try to shoot it to people, honestly, even if it's something I'm interested in. And, you know, look, I there are a lot of people out there that, you know, have an agenda and are going to always, you know, work their agenda. And when the money is at the level that things are at right now, I do understand why that happens. But, you know, like, integrity and ethics and all these things are something that have always been important to me. And I'm just never going to compromise those things. So, you know, if someone who's not even a friend of mine asks me my opinion, I'm going to try to give them my honest opinion on it. And I think that this has helped me to build a big following. I can't believe I have 20,000 Twitter followers. Like, just, I'm in shock, but I think it's cool. And I try to always shoot straight to people and, you know,
I love that.
Not have an agenda.
I love your focus on good ethics and brand and beyond important. I'm squarely in the same camp, as is everyone at Delphi. And just to switch gears a little bit, I'd love to get your thesis on just the broader generative art movement, right? Like, this is the first time, I mean, not first time, like, generative art existed, but just the ability to mint on chain instantly for an artist. Like, it's just mind blowing, right? And I mean, there's clearly, like, generative art works so well with crypto because you can form communities around the drops. You can talk with the collectors. They can be priced, traded easily, minted easily. Like, what's your take on where the entire generative art movement is going? And I'd love if you could also maybe give some color on, like, just value here, right? Like, there's, like, so many drops, like, it's hard to keep up with. But on the flip side, you know, the rare stuff is obviously going to hold value. But would love your take just on the generative art movement.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm a big fan of it. I recently, I don't know if you know who Manfred Moore is, but he's one of the pioneers of generative art, sort of doing computer generated art in the 70s. And I actually met him recently and I picked up a couple pieces by him, you know, which is super cool to have this piece that was done on a, you know, plotter printer in the 70s. And the fact that this guy was doing stuff like that, you know, at the dawn of the computer age is pretty amazing. So to see it go from that to where Art Blocks is, you know, it's super cool. And I mean, I'm definitely into generative art, and I think it has a really bright future. It, you know, for me personally, I like you said, there's so much out there. It really is hard to stay on top of it all. So, I mean, I really focus mostly on just the curated platform. That doesn't mean that there's not amazing stuff. And I do own Factory and I do own some Playground stuff. But I really just, like, in terms of keeping my collection, you know, at a top level, like, the curated stuff is what I'm primarily focused on. But, you know, what I think is interesting is, and again, you touched on it, where how it just goes so well with crypto. And I love the fact that, you know, and this is a tribute to Snowfro, you know, his ability, like, using the hash that generates the transaction to actually be the variable that goes into producing the art. It's just amazing. And, you know, something he said to me on numerous occasions, like, you know, there aren't very many pieces of art or even anything that's manufactured that goes from creation to marketplace instantly. Like, you mint your art blocks piece and immediately you can list it on OpenSea and immediately there can be a secondary market. It's just not something you see in a lot of other areas. And I'm super bullish on the space. And I feel like, you know, something like Fidenza, you know, as I've shown my collection to friends of mine that, you know, have some interest in crypto, but not really get it. Like, they're all like, oh, what's that? I'm like, oh, that's a Fidenza. And they're like, it just resonates with people on a level that a lot of stuff hasn't. And so, you know, I feel like ArtBlocks has the potential to bring generative art to a new level. And, you know, something like On Cyber, which allows you to display your amazing artwork pieces in a beautiful gallery that's 3D and allows for VR. And I'm just super bullish on the space. And like, you know, is there going to be a virtual MoMA someday? There's no doubt there's going to be a virtual MoMA someday. It might not be. I would argue there will actually be a virtual MoMA at some point, and you know, or something on that level, and you know, very possibly see interest on the level that some of these major museums have. I definitely see that as the case. So, you know, I feel like the online crypto generative art movement, it's just getting started, and I think it's got a bright future. And things like ArtBlocks are really, you know, giving space to artists to create. And, you know, ultimately, I think that there's going to be a generative Pablo Picasso or a generative Rothko equivalent, and they're probably going to get their start on ArtBlocks because that's the place to be. That's where the money's at. That's where the fans are, and you know, it's the place to get the exposure that you want. So yeah, I mean, I'm super bullish on the space and I love where it's going. I can't wait to see where it is in 5 or 10 years from now.
Now that's a killer answer. And I guess like, I don't really know how to frame this question the right way, but like, where do you see the interplay with the broader world on generative art, right? Like the traditional art community, like, you know, to be honest, I could walk in an art museum, I would have no idea what I'm looking at, right? You know, it's a lot of rich people mm-hmm. buying art, selling it to each other. But like, do you care about the interplay between like generative art and the real world and the mass community? Because like, if I send a generative art piece to my non-crypto friends, like they'll get it, right? Like they could probably understand it. They can Google it, whatever. But I mean, they could also do that for, you know, a Rothko or something in the traditional world. Like, do you care if Christie's or Sotheby's quote buys your bag? Like, do you care if this stuff is displayed in, you know, real museums? Like, what's your take on the link in with the traditional world?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's cool that places like Christie's and Sotheby's and potentially museums will be displaying this. And I think the thing that we all need to keep in mind in this space is that the collectors and artists that were in these different movements, they defined what the movement was about and what was good. And we need to make sure that we don't let outsiders define what crypto art is or what generative art is. Like, we get to decide. Like, I get to decide. You get to decide. The people that are interacting in the space get to decide. I think that, again, you know, again, bringing it back to something like Fidenza, where people that have a more traditional art background can look at that and understand it and appreciate it. It does help. And I think that those types of projects are going to be the spearhead that get generative art more into the mainstream, but recognize that they don't get to decide what crypto art and what generative art is going to look like. You know, we're going to be the ones that are going to decide it. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm excited that museums and auction houses want to get involved, but I'm not really sure, like from a Christie's or Sotheby's auction house standpoint, like they're in it because they recognize that this is art and they think they can generate fees from it. But let's also try to remember that what auction houses like Christie's and Sotheby's have provided in the past is a sense of provenance and validity. And as digitally native assets, you know, we already have unquestionable provenance and we have provable scarcity. So, you know, I'm still up in the air in terms of whether I think these institutions are going to ultimately provide any value to the crypto space and the generative art space. I think for now, we're both willing to work with each other because they want the money and we want the exposure. But ultimately, I don't see places like Christie's or Sotheby's actually being very helpful overall to what we're trying to accomplish in this space. But I welcome them being in it, and I'm thankful that they're here. It's just, I don't need Christie's to tell me this is authentic. This is a CryptoPunk or this is a Fidenza. I you know, it's all blockchain, so I have unquestionable provenance. And I think this is the big thing that separates anything in the NFT space from the outside world. You can't get unquestionable provenance in anything other than a natively digital asset. I think that's the really the big point of differentiation.
No, that's a big point. I mean, you're putting a lot of curators out of their job, or I don't know if it's curator, but I mean, anybody who has a Netflix subscription has seen like the Uncorked, the wine one with the fake wine. The art one was incredible. I forgot the name. But where the, you know, famous curator was like selling fake art that she thought was real.
Right.
That stuff's insane. And I agree with you. Like Christie's and Sotheby's, like you don't really need them, which is, it's kind of funny. Like generative art is somewhat new and you already don't need the traditional world. Like when crypto, Ethereum, Bitcoin, like, you know, was all in its earlier days, like we all couldn't wait for the traditional institutions to come in. And now, frankly, I could care less, but it's kind of like a funny dynamic how fast it worked for you to not need the traditional world there. At least
right.
for Sotheby's.
Now, ultimately, like, you know, expose, like, okay, let's just take the Sotheby's auction that happened back in was it March or April. Like, the person that bought the art block piece was not a crypto native person. It was someone who saw it, thought it was interesting, had never bought an NFT before, and bought the art block collection. That's pretty cool. So, from that standpoint, you know, I recognize that that these auction houses, they do serve value. They do provide something for us right now. But ultimately, I don't need to pay Christie's a 20% fee to sell my art blocks collection. I know I don't need to do that. So they have to, for me, they're going to have to prove their worth. Like you're charging a big fee. What do you know? And I understand why you charge those fees to other people that were not bringing you a natively digital asset, because you were somewhat putting your reputation behind it. You were providing provenance, but we don't need that. So either you have to bring your fees down, or you have to bring us buyers that we wouldn't be able to find on our own. So
it's crazy you're putting Christie's out of business just because you could check all this stuff on Etherscan. Like it's pretty much that simple.
Yes.
It's crazy.
Look, their role was provenance. Their role was to give people confidence that they were buying the real thing. I don't need them. Who needs that with a CryptoPunk? I mean, here's the day it was minted. I mean, here's the day it was claimed, and here's every single transaction, every single person that's ever touched it. I don't need an auction house. I mean, again, I think that it works for now because it's giving us the ability to bring in to get some exposure. But you know, ultimately, does Christie's or Sotheby's justify their fees? I don't think so.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I don't think they do either. And I mean, switching gears a little bit to close out on a couple of questions. Why have you? Sure. This has been incredible. Like, just on the pitfall side, like, is there anything? And this is a hard question to answer because there's not really an alternative right now. But and it's kind of vague. But what would cause you to just get completely sour or cold on like the generative art NFT art market? Like, is there anything that would trigger you to say, you know what, I'm done buying, it's time to start harvesting or go away? Is there anything that would cause that to happen for you?
Wow. I mean, that is a tough one. If there was, the cryptography got broken and you were able to somehow, you know, force a fake Fidenza into the market somehow, I don't know if that's possible, but I mean, I think that, no, I mean, I can't come up with something that would say that, okay, now I'm super bearish on things. I mean, maybe if we saw everything 100x from here, I'd be like, okay, it's way overdone. I mean, look, as someone who has a lot of experience in traditional markets as well as the digital markets, like I try to always have a relative value framework in my head. And this helps me to value assets across different asset classes. So I guess if the generative art space took on a valuation that was just so far out of whack with traditional markets, I guess I'd be a billionaire, but I guess I'd become bearish at that point. You know? So
no, that's a good reason to take cards off the table. No, it's a good answer. I mean, it's tough because you know you don't have like there's nothing new to kind of compare it to that you'd move to, and if there was, you could always get involved there as well. So it is a hard question, but appreciate your answer there.
No problem.
And I guess the other side is just on hype cycles. Like What would be your advice to people getting started in generative art today? Like, how, you know, what would be your, you know, top piece of advice for them to make sure that they stay around for a long time, but also don't become, you know, just straight up traders flipping stuff all day, unless that's the strategy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm the farthest thing from a flipper. Like I hold stuff. Like, I mean, I get called, you know, diamond hands all the time. Like, you know, I definitely have a very long-term perspective on it, and I'm seeing things from that perspective. So I think, you know, there is a lot of short-termism in crypto and NFTs. So I think that by taking a longer-term approach, you have a better chance of surviving. You know, you should only be playing with money that, you know, you understand could effectively evaporate. You know, when you're playing in an asset class that has the potential to move 10x, 100x, even 1000x, like, you've got to recognize that that's not a quote unquote safe asset class, that there's going to be a lot of risk and volatility. So, you know, the advice I would give anyone starting off is first buy what you like and what you're drawn to and what you find interesting. And, you know, try to look at things differently than everybody else is looking at them, because that's how you're going to find differentiation. And you might see something that other people aren't seeing, or you might be looking at something a little bit differently, and focus on that and try to find something that speaks to you. I would definitely say, you know, if you're buying something at 3 ETH to relist at 3.5 ETH, you're not going to make it. You have no chance doing it that way. What'll end up happening is you'll sell all your winners for up 0.5 ETH, and you'll be sitting with a bag of crap that's worth nothing. So I strongly advise people not to get involved in that game. Try not to get caught up in hype.
What do you like? What's your advice though for, like, let's say I have 10 NFTs in my wallet. I'm looking at them on OpenSea. I bought them for, you know, 0.1 ETH each, and I'm getting an OpenSea email saying, hey, these are going for, you know, 2-3 ETH, you know, 20-30x what I paid. Like, obviously most people would jump to sell, but I guess what you're saying is, if they're getting bid up, there's obviously a reason you should keep it. But I guess, how do you judge the short-term pump versus kind of a long-term narrative there?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the first thing, and someone recently contacted me asking me about this question exactly. And I would never base my sell decision based on how many times it's gone up. So yeah, I understand, like, those emails should wake you up to say, okay, something's happening here. I need to start looking at it. And then what I would do is I would look at the 10 that I owned, and I would pick the 3 that I thought were the least desirable of the 10 I owned. And I'd list them, you know, I'd look at the floor price, because, you know, typically if you're getting these OpenSea's bid emails, the market's at least 30% higher than what those bids are. So I think this is a thing that people don't understand, and people definitely screw up, especially inexperienced people, is if you only keep raising your prices, you are never going to sell anything. So, you know, when something you own sells that, you know, you paid 0.1 ETH for that you have 20 of, and you start seeing them trade at, you know, 1.5, 2, 2.5 ETH, don't be afraid to put a couple out there at 2.75, 3, 3.25. Sell a third of them. You know, a very wise trader once told me nobody ever lost money taking a profit. So try to keep that in mind. Always try to take profits. It's always easier to sell into a strong market. Sell when you can, not when you have to. These are basic trading principles that I always try to live by. And so, you know, I'm always thinking about the next pump, and I always try to have some stuff offered 25%, 30%, 50% above the market, so that when those pumps happen, I'm able to take advantage of it, take some liquidity out of the market. And also, you know, as someone who's watched very closely and my actions can have strong impacts on markets, I don't want to be undercutting floors pretty much ever, because that looks bad. So I always want to have a couple of things that I'm interested in selling already out there. So when the pump happens, it's not like, oh, look at bond selling. Nope, that thing's been up there for a month. I'm not selling. It's all pre-planned.
So those are
things that I try to do.
No, that's really good advice. And I guess last question for you, is there anything that you're really excited about in the gen art space, NFT art space, et cetera, maybe project, maybe tech update, maybe platform, anything that you're looking forward to that's going to be a big deal or people should keep their eyes on?
Yes, on cyber. This thing is going to change the game. If you're not involved in on cyber, if you're not playing with these NFTs, if you're not creating galleries, you're making a mistake. This, to me, this is one of the most interesting things that's happening in NFTs. It's great for punks. It's great for autoglyphs. It's great for art blocks. The ability to display your art in a cohesive, interesting, engaging manner, the ability to eventually link these galleries together, the ability to potentially have multiplayer where you have avatars walking around in these worlds and interacting with other people and potentially even being able to sell from these platforms. Like, I'm super, 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 super impressed with On Cyber. One of the most impressive things I've seen in the space in a while. That would be what I would say.
It's 3D galleries to showcase your NFTs?
Yes. So you can buy an NFT of a different gallery. They also have free galleries. So you can go and get a free gallery, and it's, you know, more limited in its functionality. They're paid for. The galleries that you buy are, you know, finite in number currently. And like, if you go to my Twitter feed, I have it pinned. My art blocks gallery is in my art blocks gallery, is in the, my Genesis On Cyber gallery. And it would give you a very good feel for what's happening there. And like, I mean, the first time I saw that these On Cyber galleries, I had been looking around for a way to display my art blocks in a easy to use, very user-friendly format. And I came across On Cyber, and immediately I was like, wow, this is awesome. And I started having conversations with Ryan, who's the developer for it. Super responsive. The guy really gets it. I cannot say enough about this. This is definitely, in my opinion, one of the biggest game changers for NFTs. Single-handedly could take art blocks to the next level, because up until then, the only way you could really look at your art blocks collection was on OpenSea or, you know, some other way to view it, but not like in a gallery feel. So I'm very, very, very bullish on cyber. Really, really like what they're doing. And I think that, you know, we're going to see amazing things happen from them going forward.
No, I like that. Definitely check it out. I'll link it. The one thing, have you seen anybody create a way to showcase like your NFTs from different wallets without saying, like, I guess like verifying they're in your wallet, but not doxing the address? Like, is there any way to kind of show that in maybe a ZK kind of way or anything like that? Because like, I'd love to create a gallery, but I think people are kind of concerned that like they want to just showcase specific NFTs and prove they own it, but not dox their address. I know that might be somewhat impossible right now, but.
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, I will tell you this. I started putting out my On Cyber galleries and, you know, bring some attention to my collection and bringing some attention to On Cyber. And I found that Ryan was, you know, extremely receptive to ideas from collectors. And the one thing I like about On Cyber is, yes, everything that you display in your gallery, you have to link your wallet to prove that you own everything. But I mean, look, when I hang up with you, I'm going to talk to him and say, is there a way to do this where you guys verify that the owner of the gallery owns all these assets, but doesn't dox the wallet address? I think that's a very easy thing for him to do and could easily do that.
Awesome. No, that would be great. I'm just clicking around on the Vincent Van Gogh gallery while I have you. It's pretty cool. Well, Von Mises, this has been incredible, man. Your experience with art blocks, not only as a mod, but on the curation side. And I mean, your like NFT collection is just insane. I mean, the pieces you have, the quantity of assets you have, and I don't mean to just throw out there as like a stat, but I hope people understand the time and effort that goes into like actually collecting at that level and deciding, you know, every day what's important and what's not important to get to the place that you're at today. So I think everyone should check out your gallery. They should check out On Cyber. And I'd love to have you on again in the future. You just have sure. A ton of information here.
Nice. It was a blast. I had a lot of fun doing it. I mean, an hour and change flew by and quickly. It was very cool. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much, Thomas. We'll talk soon.
Before we go, we'd like to thank our sponsors for making this episode possible. With a proven track record of delivering products safely, the Kava platform is DeFi's most trusted, scalable, and secure institutional-grade cross-chain engine. In addition to the protocols Kava and Hard, the Kava platform is launching Swap Protocol, a cross-chain AMM liquidity hub bridging DeFi, blockchains, and financial services to swap the world's largest assets and maximize yields across your entire portfolio. Try for yourself or learn more today by visiting kava.io. Celo is an open platform for mobile-first DeFi with a vision of bringing decentralized financial tools and services to anyone with a mobile phone. Eco-friendly, Ethereum-compatible, and governed by Celo holders, Celo's proof-of-stake consensus mechanism and automatic daily carbon offsets make Celo the world's first carbon-negative blockchain, offsetting over 2,200 tons of carbon to date. To learn more about how to lend, earn, and stake with Celo's growing family of platform-native stablecoins, visit Celo.org today. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.